There is always a chessboard on Bob Jamison's coffee table.
Watch him, Bob. Watch him now.
He learned to play in high school when a girl suggested he go out for the chess club.
Some girl always talking me into something. Ain't that deep.
Bob isn't a dabbler. For years, he'd take a board to the bar and play anyone who was interested. He's played thousands of games. The moves unfold in his head.
If you think I just play for a pawn, you just play for a pawn. I'm a positional player.
He doesn't just understand the game. Bob understands people.
Oh, okay.
It's not enough to outmaneuver you. He wants to get in your head.
Go move into the lion's den. That's all I want you to do. Step in the lion's den, see what happened to you.
Bob is the kind of guy you want to help you solve your problem. Because once he's in, he's in. That's how 5 years ago, Bob Jamison ended up playing for the highest possible stakes. Home.
Well, I just start piecing stuff together. Like I said, it just made sense to me that, like, there's some sort of plan.
From 90.5 WESA, this is Land and Power. Who has it, what they do with it, and how that shapes the cities around us. I'm Margaret J. Krause. Land and Power looks at one neighborhood in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania called East Liberty, home to Bob Jamison's apartment complex, the Penn Plaza Apartments. It's been 5 years since Bob and all his neighbors learned they'd have to move out. The news arrived like a pronouncement. East Liberty isn't for you anymore. If you live in a city, this story might sound familiar. At first, after decades of disinvestment, a neighborhood starts to change. A developer sees an opportunity to turn an old apartment building into something new. The people who live there get pushed away from their families, their doctors, their places of worship. Nearly every city in America shares this story, because they all rode the same 20th century roller coaster, from thriving to floundering, and then thriving again. By the early 2000s, so many people across the country wanted to live in cities, it touched off a housing crisis. But in Pittsburgh, this is a surprising story and confusing because there is so much housing here. Pittsburgh is still the land of the $140,000 house, even the 20 grand fixer-upper. Pittsburgh lost half its population in the 1980s when manufacturing collapsed, and those people, they never came back. How can a city with room for twice as many residents push people out? Land and Power goes beyond what happened in East Liberty to explain how it happened. So often in these stories, developers are the bad guys, activists are the good guys, and residents are the victims. But it's never that simple. Land and Power explores how one place becomes another, and what that means for the people who used to call it home. How even when everyone thinks they're doing the right thing, people still get hurt. That hurt sticks around, and that shapes our cities too. Today, when your powerful landlord tells you to leave home, what choice do you really have?
Oh, okay, all right, great. I'll see you shortly.
The first time I met Bob Jamison, he wore a quarter-zip sweater exactly the color of butternut squash.
How you doing?
Good, how are you doing?
All right.
Thank you.
He had on a black wool cap, freshly shined shoes, and he wore the easy grace of a dancer. Bob grew up in the 1950s, when dressing one's best was practically a social obligation. Bob Jamison has style. He appreciates style. It's one of the things he appreciated about the Penn Plaza Apartments when they first opened in East Liberty, a few miles away from where Bob grew up.
When I first used to visit, right, the apartments, they were gorgeous.
Penn Plaza opened in 1967. His best friend moved there while he and Bob were still in community college. Big green lawns surrounded the two buildings. One was 7 stories high and the other was 9. The 312 units were intended for moderate-income families like Bob's best friend, newly married, still in school. People remember doctors and lawyers, too. East Liberty and Penn Plaza seemed to have everything. There was a full-service grocery store a block away, and the building had its own stop-and-go food store. A jazz club opened on the first floor. Each apartment at Penn Plaza had these big plate glass windows that framed views of the neighborhood's busy shops and its tall church spires. They flooded the apartments with light.
The rooms were spacious, you know, and it was new, new apartment building.
In the late 1960s and early 1970s, a lot of East Liberty felt new. City officials had just given the neighborhood a makeover as part of an effort called urban renewal. urban renewal is really important to the story of East Liberty and Penn Plaza. It was a federal program that gave cities the power and the money to remake whole neighborhoods. We'll get into this in a later episode, but for now, just know that urban renewal was a major shakeup in Pittsburgh, with far-reaching consequences. East Liberty's new look drew inspiration from the pedestrian plazas of Europe. Cars were banished from the main drag to give pedestrians free roam. Five large apartment complexes were built around the neighborhood's edge. Penn Plaza sat right across from Penley Park, the new home to one of Major League Baseball's biggest stars, Roberto Clemente.
Hello, Dwayne.
How you doing? Let me grab my
hat. Dwayne Reeder runs the Clemente Museum, and he says Roberto's wife Vera answered a lot of calls when the neighborhood kids found out exactly who lived in apartment F92.
They would go ring Roberto's buzzer, and Vera would say, hello, and they would say, can Roberto come out and play? And she'd be like, no, he's sleeping, or he's getting ready for the ball game.
It says something about the excitement of the place that a baseball star and half a dozen teammates chose to live in East Liberty. It also says something about why people live where they do in Pittsburgh. Geographically speaking, Pittsburgh is a wild place. The city covers 58 square miles of earth in the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania. It's where the Monongahela and Allegheny Rivers meet to form the Ohio. Those miles don't lay flat, stretching easily from one horizon to another. They roll up steep hills and down deep valleys. The city's 90 neighborhoods burrow into riverfronts. Wood-sided houses huddle together to avoid falling off their cliff faces. The city's geography unites people. There's a perverse pride in how absurd these roads are, but the hills and rivers separate people, too. Policy and prejudice deepened those divides and made Pittsburgh one of America's most segregated cities. East Liberty is one of just a handful of truly flat neighborhoods, and for almost its entire history was home to a diverse group of people. For a long time, they lived sorted into what people remember as the Italian side, the Black side. By the late 60s and early 70s, though, those lines started to relax. It was one of the reasons Roberto Clemente, a Black man from Puerto Rico, lived there. It was still pretty segregated, but the civil rights movement was shifting East Liberty's identity. The new apartment complexes helped. They were open to everyone. Places and people don't change overnight, but East Liberty provided some hope that things could be different. Things were shifting in Bob Jamison's life, too. He studied mathematics at the Community College of Allegheny County. He helped start the first Black student organization on campus. But the college seemed to be stonewalling them. The lectures and events they proposed were denied. He went to see the administration about it.
We don't got nothing to do with that. That money is tied up in student government activity fee. You have to go to student government because they control the activity fee.
So, Bob went to meet with student government.
All white guys. They say, man, y'all ain't doing this. Y'all don't never let us have anything. So this chump says, nah, we ain't having nothing for you. If you don't like it, run for student government. Well, you said that to the wrong person.
Bob's mother raised him never to start a fight, but not to run from one either. It made Martin Luther King Jr.'s turn-the-other-cheek mentality kind of tough to swallow. When he found the biography of Malcolm X in his elementary school, he says it woke him up. Just a quick note on some of the sound you're about to hear. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, I conducted some interviews remotely.
Malcolm X was, if you smack me, I'm smacking you back. A racist system tries to keep you down. And you have to, like, fight against that no matter the cost. If they build a wall, tear the wall down. If you can't tear the wall down, try to go around it. If you can't go around it, go under it. If you can't go under it, go over it. You know what I mean? And that's how I was.
Bob didn't run for office. Instead, he was the kingmaker. He worked the hallways and the quad. And in the next election, he delivered victory to the college's first Black student president and three Black student senators. Bob encountered one of the first real walls in his life, and he tore it down.
Even when the system is rigged against you, you have to go into the system to make corrections.
Bob took that mentality with him when he left school to work on the railroad. Turns out the money was way better laying tracks than teaching college math. In 1975, he bought a house a couple miles from East Liberty in a neighborhood called Lincoln Leamington.
When you break it down, like finance number-wise, it's cheaper to pay a mortgage than there is rent, you know. always figured it's better to own than to rent.
But as Bob got older, homeownership got less and less appealing.
I couldn't keep up with the repairs physically because of the kind of job I had. I had to do a lot of traveling, spend a lot of hours. And when I come home from working on the railroad, you know, I didn't feel like fixing roofs and stuff like that did.
His two kids were grown up with places of their own, and he was away a lot. Work was demanding. That's why, a few years before he retired, East Liberty came back into his life. It had been a long time, but his fondness for Penn Plaza remained. So we went to see it one day.
I thought it was a nice apartment building, like the location in the middle of everything, you know. Lots of transportation, close to the shops.
Bob moved in 2008, and Penn Plaza wasn't the thrilling image of modernity it had once been. A daycare had replaced the jazz club. Some people thought it was an eyesore. Some people told me it wasn't well taken care of. But for a lot of people, and for Bob, it was just the ticket. All he had to do was pay the bills and go to work. No trips to Home Depot required. When he finally retired, Bob discovered a new community. There were a lot of people like Bob in the building, retired women and men who wanted the convenience of a city apartment, time to spend on their hobbies and with their families. On nice days, they'd gather on the lawn.
They would be out there drinking their wine and their beer, you know, and telling their stories. You know how guys do get together, and the fish was much bigger than what it actually was. You know, she was a movie star, you know. Max was a movie star. No, she wasn't a movie star. You know, you need to cut that out.
Bob cooked a lot. He kept a stocked bar, even though he doesn't really drink.
You know, I drink a beer every now and then. I used to keep liquor.
He kept an open door.
I made a lot of friends. I made a lot of female friends. And they would come by every day.
Sometimes it was sort of stressful. He's a people person, but Bob cherishes his alone time.
There's certain days that I like to be by myself, you know, especially with my sports. Like on Sunday, sometime women would come by right before the Steeler game. And it's like, I cannot give you the proper attention about what's going on in your life while the game is on.
He'd go for walks in the neighborhood, just spend some time walking and thinking. That's when he first started to really notice how East Liberty had changed.
At first, I couldn't figure out what was going on.
In 2010, Google opened its Pittsburgh office in East Liberty's old Nabisco plant.
I could tell something was up because I could tell how the area was changing.
New buildings are going up faster than the weeds they're replacing.
In 2011, Target went up on the site of an old housing tower.
East Liberty has seen a lot of change over the years, and now it is in the midst of another boom.
The police started policing the area more, running people off.
A co-working space opened, and then a coffee shop. There were more white people in the neighborhood. Some of the long-term businesses were closing. Bob wasn't the only resident who noticed how quickly things seemed to be shifting. Philip Walker moved to Penn Plaza in 1976. He remembers comments, offhand, from people outside the building.
You heard it a while back, then it became a little bit more, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming.
Donald Thomas grew up in East Liberty.
You can sense the change coming. You knew. You knew from stories on TV.
East Liberty is back. Sheldon Ingram shows us how East Liberty has become a destination location.
Some more recent arrivals to East Liberty, like Gail Williams, didn't think much of it.
Because there was always rumors going through East Liberty, because they was always tearing down, building up, tearing down, building up.
All these restaurants start popping up.
One national consulting firm predicted that Whole Foods would spark the growth of restaurants.
And I said, you're going to have customers, right? So where is the customers going to come from?
And I kept saying, the only way I'll move out of here is they're going to have to tear this building down from up under me.
Hundreds here scrambling to find new places to call home tonight. Neighbors in the Penn Plaza apartment surprised by eviction notices being slid underneath their doors.
The letters seemed to be everywhere and nowhere. Some people found them under their doors. Some were in their mailboxes. This letter is to inform you that we will not be renewing nor extending your lease agreement. Crystal Jennings lived just up the street from her dad's apartment at Penn Plaza. She was at work when her phone rang.
You know, Crystal, they just put a notice on our doors and we have to be out of 90 days. So I'm like, what are you going to do?
More people didn't get letters than did. So it was hard to know for sure what was happening. There didn't seem to be any kind of pattern. It wasn't people late on their rent. It wasn't one or the other building. It wasn't whole floors. The randomness was scary. Who would be next? Karen Edmonds remembers talking one night with her husband, O'Harold Hoots.
We even broke down and cried because we felt that the neighbors, we were being pulled apart from people that we knew.
Donald Thomas says the expectation of bad news weighed people down.
They were afraid. They didn't know what to do. They thought the marshals were going to come and put their stuff in the street and evict them physically.
Some of the people who did get a letter or heard about the letters just left. To them, it was clear. Your landlord tells you to go, you go. Toni Lyman squeezed apartment viewings into her lunch breaks. It was so stressful, she started to lose her hair and stopped. One man went to the hospital with heart trouble. And the more Ruth Wooding thought about it, the madder she felt.
It was just really wrong for the way they went at it. This is my home here.
People started to wonder about the person who owned Penn Plaza, Larry Gumberg, one of the city's bigger players in real estate.
It's like I was trying to explain to you about the aristocrats and the peasants.
Bob didn't get a letter himself, but he heard the rumors. They didn't really surprise him.
Peasants' way of life don't even come into consideration to aristocrats.
This was exactly Bob's kind of fight. But for the first time in his adult life, Bob was tired. Really and truly tired.
Just wanted to be a tenant.
He'd only been retired for 3 years. And a lot of that time he spent shuttling back and forth to doctor's appointments. Routine blood work had revealed cancer.
When you're fighting to stay alive, you know, that's what's important to you, to wake up in the morning.
Bob started to see flyers advertising tenant meetings, urging people to organize and push back. He went back and forth on whether to get involved.
In the back of my mind, at any time I could have a first month and a last month and a security deposit.
But he looked around at his neighbors who didn't have the money for a new place, who didn't have the time or the energy to get their affairs in order in 90 days. He felt the old twinge.
And here goes another thing from Malcolm. If you ain't part of the solution, you part of the problem.
He kind of bargained with himself. He'd go to these meetings. He'd speak up if he had something to say, something to offer. But he wasn't going to lead anything. Bob hadn't counted on Gail Williams.
Gail is a freight train.
Gail Williams was raised just over the Pittsburgh city line in a steel town small enough to feel like the country.
I've always liked city life.
Gail moved to Penn Plaza in 2011 or 2012. She can't quite remember, but right around the time that Bob retired, she settled into a fourth floor apartment.
I like how the sun came in. It was peaceful. It was quiet. And it was clean.
Gail is the kind of person who doesn't walk, she marches. She'll tell you exactly what's on her mind. One of her favorite t-shirts reads, "You may not like me, but Jesus thinks I'm to die for." When Gail's daughter Lillian Great went to grad school, she moved into Penn Plaza too with her son. They lived right on Gail's floor. Gail took her grandson to and from school, and in the afternoons they'd go to the park behind Penn Plaza. While he and the other kids ran endless laps between the swings and the jungle gyms, Gail would sit and watch. She'd chat with the parents and the grandparents. Teenagers and young adults at the park started to call her the mayor.
No, honey, you can't be smoking that over here. Can't you see these children? No, you can't drink that out here. Don't you see these children?
Gail kept a close eye on Penn Plaza, too.
You know, my daughter used to say, "Mom, get out my window." Quit screaming at the people. I said, "No problem, I'll go downstairs and scream at them."
Gail felt a sense of ownership for her home and for East Liberty. The news that she and all of her neighbors were suddenly staring down another apartment hunt did not sit well with Gail.
I was really pissed off and angry that someone was so insensitive as not to see the needs of the people that were being put out.
She waited for her letter to have the facts in hand, but it didn't arrive. She couldn't stop thinking about what was happening. How could anyone do this?
I understand you own land. I understand you got big money. I understand all that, but there's still people that don't have your money. They don't have your land. They just have this apartment that they're paying you to stay in.
Gail knew it was totally legal to send out these letters, but to her, legal doesn't mean right. She wanted to do something, but she knew she needed to act strategically. On the fourth floor, three floors below where Bob was weighing his options, Gail started to formulate a plan. With the help of the state representative's office, She drafted a letter of her own. Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
Americans are grappling with a huge question right now. Can we trust the cops?
These are the different reasons people were put on the list. Falsifying reports or records.
What if I told you that in states all across the country,
issuance of unlawful orders,
there are lists that could tell you if individual cops were trustworthy.
Obedience to laws and policies.
These lists can draw a straight line from an officer's name to past misconduct. The problem is, there's a good chance you're not allowed to see them.
To turn a blind eye is basically saying, well, I hope the justice system works. That's not good enough for me.
I'm Jason Moon. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Document, Season 1, The List, a podcast about one state's decades of secrecy around police misconduct. Binge all the episodes now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The letter that Gail Williams wrote went to every elected official she could think of. Her city council person, the mayor, the county executive. It said there'd be a meeting in 2 weeks to discuss the situation. The state representative she worked with even hand-delivered some of the letters. Meanwhile, other people worked with a local advocacy group to start organizing. They knocked doors, encouraging people to come strategize about how they could save their homes. It was around this time that Gail and Bob finally crossed paths.
When I first met Gail, I didn't like her, right? Because she has a dominating personality.
I like Robert. He's highly intelligent, and he dresses well. And he can hold a conversation with the best of them.
I have a dominating personality, too, to a certain extent. But it's not. I'd rather persuade you to see where I'm coming from.
I said, a man needs to be involved in this. Women are involved in too many things.
Gail's a fighter. And she ain't scared. She ain't scared of nothing.
Despite Gail's insistence that Bob would be very helpful to the organizing effort, he didn't commit to anything. Not yet. He'd think about it. The big meeting with elected officials was getting closer. Gail says she made it clear to them that attendance was not optional.
Because if you don't show the news, people will be there. And they're going to ask, you know, where are our representatives?
The meeting was held just across the street from Penn Plaza at the East Liberty Lutheran Church on Penn Avenue. It was the middle of July, hot. The grass out front was dead from heat. The air in the room thickened as more people settled into their seats. The mayor, the councilperson, the county executive, the state representative, they were all there. They'd all succumbed to Gail's prodding. They sat at a long table at the very front of the room. People fanned themselves with the flyers handed out by organizers.
Good morning, everybody.
A couple of people took the podium and they gave short speeches about how changes in East Liberty seemed to leave less and less room for people like themselves. They said there was strength in numbers. They encouraged people to get involved. But the crowd was restless. For weeks, they'd been living in a state of anxiety and uncertainty. They were unsure of what they should do or where to go if they really did have to go.
We will get to questions and answers, but
tempers were short and the stakes were high. As the speeches went on, people seemed to lose their patience. The housing activist with the mic quickly abandoned ship and waved Gail up to the podium.
Listen, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, it's never too late to organize. It's never too late.
Yes.
It's never too late. As long as you got breath in your body, it's never too late. Because they have to recognize who we are as people.
Eventually, Mayor Bill Peduto took the mic.
I can't even imagine the anxiety that you must be feeling. I can't imagine if I walked home one day and somebody put something in my mail that said you have to leave in 90 days.
The mayor told the crowd he had just learned about it a few days earlier and that his administration was ready to take a stand.
And so that other developers will know around the city, we don't do business this way. It's not about the brick and mortar and what will replace it. It's about the people that live inside of it.
Bob didn't say anything at the meeting. He just took it all in.
I didn't have a lot of positive expectations, right? Because usually these things don't work out in favor of the people.
Back in apartment 702, he called his son Ty Lee Thompson.
Ty Lee Akili is his middle name, and that means seeker of knowledge and common sense.
Ty Lee leads a community violence prevention initiative. He volunteers for Get Out the Vote efforts. He used to coach his son's baseball team. I learned all these things about Ty Lee in roughly 30 seconds. I asked Bob about that phone call with his son, and the details poured out.
My son, to me, is a better man. And that's how you want your kids to grow up. You want them to be better than you. I think everybody wants that, right?
In chess, though, Bob reckons they're just about an equal match.
But I think I'm maybe a couple points better, which ain't much in chess.
I sat in on their regular match one evening. Neither Bob nor Ty Lee remembers when they first started playing together. It's one of those things that seems like it's always been there. The chess clock, the popcorn, the trash talk.
I'm coming for you now. I'm gonna go up in your house and just take what I want.
Like most longtime competitors, they're intimately familiar with each other's strengths and weaknesses, the feints and facades.
I've been playing. I mean, you've been playing.
No, I ain't. Well, yeah.
See, he's lying already. He's lying already. He's been playing the color skits. Kicking their butt, too.
Bob had said Ty Lee talked him into getting involved in Penn Plaza. As I watched them play...
He set me up. It looked like I got a good move, but this is a setup.
I could almost hear that phone call.
I was shocked. And then I definitely remember saying that he should help the people stand up.
You know, and I was like, man, I don't really want to get involved in a professional manner like this here, right? I'm just a tenant.
You're not going to fight? Like, what's wrong with you? But you done lost your fight?
It wasn't about guilting him.
It was a move on the board, if you search it.
It was about reminding Bob who he is.
Look at him.
They both knew Bob could help, but he can't stand an injustice.
Look what he's trying to do.
It's just that Ty Lee saw the play before Bob did.
The developers is trying to take what you got. You gotta fight him. You gotta fight him. You gotta fight him.
But who was Bob fighting? A lot has been said about the owner and would-be developer of the Penn Plaza Apartments, Lawrence Gumberg. Next time on Land and Power, we meet the man everyone thinks they know. Land and Power is a production of 90.5 WESA, reported and hosted by me, Margaret J. Krause. The show was edited and produced by Liz Reed. Production help from Katie Blackley, Kylie Kaczynski, and Sarah Kovash. Fact-checking by Sonu Babu, Patrick Doyle, Mary Rose O'Donnell, Isabel Schmeller, and Naomi Sterobin. Special thanks to NPR's Story Lab team, including Uri Berliner, Nigeri Eden, Adelina Lansianese, Michael May, and Yowei Shaw. Thanks also goes to Bill Bartlett, David Boylan, Kate Gimarisi, and Brian Izette. Chris Ivey, John Miller, Larkin Page Jacobs, Lucy Perkins, Chris Potter, and Ellis Robinson. Robert Romito, Celeste Scott, and Mary Lee Williams. We've got photos of Bob, Gail, Penn Plaza, East Liberty, and more at landandpowerpod.com.